This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you. If you combine the number of words in the concordat and the number of words in my job title, it gets a little bit absurd. They've given me the graveyard shift, so I'm going to be looking and seeing if anybody dozes off because they have had a large lunch, and I'll be pointing them out to everyone. My name's Tom Papworth. I am the Research Concordat Implementation Coordinator. I'm going to basically put the concordat into context for you, outline the seven principles, and then briefly say both how we're demonstrating activity in this area and how it aligns with the European Charter and Code, which is a parallel piece of regulation that affects all academia in Europe. I think this starts back in the 90s with there was a 1996 concordat, which I'm sure you're all very familiar with, and which had some impact in across the sector, but perhaps not as much as people would have liked. And I think that was there's a recognition that was because while the concordat was signed up to by all the institutions, there was no motor behind it to ensure that momentum was maintained. And in light of emerging thinking, particularly around things such as Gareth Roberts' Set for Success report, people began to think that maybe we needed to renew the Concordat and also to provide a motor to ensure that compliance was pushed forward. There's a nice quote here by Gareth Roberts that basically makes the point that PhDs are not about producing feces, they're about producing people, they're about producing minds and people with a set of skills. And this is increasingly important, and what Gareth Roberts recognised was that this was important for two reasons. Firstly, that we needed to improve the quality of our research staff so that we can improve the quality of research outcomes, but also that we're now competing internationally more and more, and that we want to both attract the best researchers from abroad by offering the best environment for them to come and work in, and also prepare our research staff to be able to go out there and compete internationally. It's all part of a kind of much larger HE agenda, and this is just some of it. There's Gareth up in the top left-hand corner next to that smiling gentleman. You'll notice the European Charter and Code there in the middle as well, and the Concordat near the right at the top, and there's all this down the bottom as well. And this is just some of the many strands that are feeding into higher education at the moment. The Concordat specifically basically sets out what all the different players that affect research staff are expected to do. It's an agreement between research staff, research leaders, employers, and funders to ensure that they all address research careers and they all focus on what contribution they can make. Particularly looking at research staff, it's what research staff can expect of their employers, can expect of their managers, can expect of funders, but also what's expected of them. And I'll get back into that in a moment, but suffice to say that the initiative ultimately has to be with the research staff themselves. I'll take us through seven principles, starting with principle one, the recognition and the importance of recruiting, selecting, and retaining researchers with the highest potential to achieve excellence in research. That last bit is key. This is about excellence in research. This is not some fluffy HR stuff. This is about how we will attract the best researchers, how we will make our researchers the best, and how we will ultimately get the best results out of our research so that we can continue to be a world-leading centre of research. Now, in practice, that means a number of things to a number of people. So, for example, institutions will want to set out how pay and grading is determined. Employers will want to be informative and transparent in how they set their policies and procedures. Research managers will need to have relevant training if they're going to participate in recruitment panels. Those supporting research, the staff developers, will need to provide guidance that's useful and germane. And the researchers themselves will need to be informed about the relevant policies that affect them. Not unrelated to that, the second principle is that researchers are recognised and valued by their employing institutions as an essential part of their core strategy. Partly this is about treating them equally with academic staff. There is a perception, at least, that research staff, because they tend to be on fixed-term contracts, are not treated equally with the academic staff. This is basically about valuing their contribution. Employers need to be making sure that PIs, for example, are taking their management responsibilities seriously, that they're providing opportunities for training, that they're supporting their staff, and the employers need to be rewarding good management. They need to be ensuring that their PIs are aware of their responsibilities and have the skills to take them forward. Funders need to consider how their policies and procedures impact upon research staff. Research managers themselves need to understand their responsibilities, and I can't emphasise that last one enough, because too often I speak to PIs and too often they're not fully aware of what their role is as the managers of their research staff. Sometimes they think that actually the management responsibilities lie somewhere else, but actually it is the PIs who are the managers. It's the PIs to whom the research staff are looking, and ultimately it's the PIs that are going to have to deal with any grievances that occur. So I think they need to be made aware of their responsibilities, but I think they also need to be provided with the skills and training that they need to take that forward and take it seriously. I think supporters of research staff need to make it clear to research staff how they can, for example, become permanent and how they can get promotion. And again, the researchers themselves need to be aware of how all these things impact upon themselves. Principle three looks at equipping and supporting the researchers to be flexible in this mobile and global research environment. Ultimately, most research staff will not continue in a smooth, linear academic career, and we need to prepare them to be able to leave the academic sector and find work elsewhere. And we also need to be willing to increasingly recognise the skills that they have, that people develop outside the sector, and being able to integrate them back in. From an employer's perspective, that might mean that they have an institutional strategy in place for the career development of their staff. Funders need to help researchers make informed choices about their career progression. Research managers themselves need to actively encourage their researchers to undertake continuous professional development, to train in a broad range of skills, to attend conferences, to publish papers, to make their own funding bids, and even to build the networks that are essential to progress an academic career, not least because we know that a large number of jobs in academia are not advertised in the traditional manner, but people use their networks to identify people who would be able to do particular jobs. It's very important that the researchers too are aware of both the variety of career paths that are open to them, and the skills they will need to pursue those. Principle four, in many ways, is very similar to principle three, but it looks perhaps more specifically at things such as training and the importance of providing appraisal and advice. Particularly, again, there's a responsibility here for research managers to provide regular appraisal, to be honest and transparent in the advice that they're giving to their research staff, and to be frank about their prospects, and to be open, and to encourage their researchers to be open-minded about their career paths. Actually, very few research staff will end up in permanent academic careers, perhaps fewer than the research staff are themselves aware. And it's important that they, at an early stage, recognise that and develop a whole wide range of skills so that they are able to compete in whatever career paths they follow. As I said, absolutely the core to this, however, is that the research staff need to take the initiative themselves. This is not something that's going to happen if they don't push for it. We hear anecdotes of research staff going to the staff development office and saying, I'm aware that when my fixed-term contract comes to an end, my future's uncertain, and I'm not sure I have all the skills and the training, and the research staff developer will say, okay, well, when does your fixed-term contract end? And the research staff will say Friday. And this is a real problem because these are people who are very focused on their research, and they're not necessarily focusing as much on their career as they need to be. And we need to encourage them, and they need to grasp themselves the importance of having that long-term perspective on what they will be doing in their next role. Also, frankly, if this is going to achieve anything, it's going to be achieved through revolution from below. And I genuinely believe that the entire research staff development agenda will be achieved as a result of research staff themselves becoming increasingly demanding about the opportunities that are provided to them. And that's a very powerful driver, and that's the one we should welcome. Inevitably, there is an equality and diversity strand to this, but I think it's important to say that this isn't just about compliance with equality and diversity law. It's partly about a drive for best practice, but it's partly as well a recognition that there are particular challenges within the higher education sector. For example, the long hours culture, the fact that in some research one has to be available 24/7. I'm reminded of a friend of mine who's a researcher who was running a particular experiment, and it just had to be topped up every 4 hours. I mean, there was nothing to do in between, but for an extended period, he would be coming back into the lab every 4 hours to finesse his experiment. Interestingly, his experience now actually raises another issue, which is about flexible working. He's just been offered a job in Scotland around the same time that he's discovered he's also going to have a child with his partner who is working in London. So he will now be going up to work at the University of Glasgow and commuting back down to London at the weekends. I suspect it will be very important for him to be able to work compressed hours, to be able to do some of his work on that 4 or 5 hour train journey. And I think that it's very important, if we are going to be able to keep some of the greatest minds in research in British academia, that we are able to accommodate people's complex lives. And finally, Principle 7, however, because it's not all your work, a lot of it's mine, and this is the area where a lot of it falls to me. As I said, part of the reason why the 96 Concordat didn't perhaps achieve as much as it might have done is because nobody was there wasn't a full impetus and a driver behind it. And based on the principle that what gets measured matters, we felt that it was important to monitor progress in this sector and also to be able to demonstrate that this was having a positive effect. Actually, before we even did that, what we did was we created a strategy group that would oversee the Concordat and take ownership for it, that represents higher education institutions themselves, represents the funders, represents the research staff, represents the sector across the board. And they then devised 6 benchmarking projects, which I'm briefly going to outline, that would hopefully demonstrate that activity was taking place and that the experienced research staff was getting better. We also agreed to start publishing biennial reports, because that way people will be able to track our progress. As I said, I'll briefly outline these. There are 6 benchmarking programs. Some of them will be more familiar to you than others. I won't do them in the order they're listed here. The Careers in Research Online Survey you're probably all aware of, and I know that it was run in, I think, 51 institutions representing about 3/4 of the research staff in this country, and it was very successful, and we've learned a lot from it. What we hope will complement that is the Understanding the Research Staff Cohort project, which is basically trying to fill the gaps we have in our knowledge of who these people are. Surprisingly, even within institutions, some institutions could not give you a comprehensive list of who is doing research within that institution. The third, and the one that I'm sure that you're all very aware of, because it's currently live, is the HEI Strategy Survey, which was launched in January and will run until April, and is an attempt to look at the approaches that institutions are taking. If Cross and the Understanding the Research Staff Cohort look at the research staff themselves, the HEI Strategy looks at the employers to see what they're doing to push this forward. And then, as you see, we go down, we start to touch upon other people as well. Reviewing the use of fixed-term contracts also looks at how the institutions are responding to that challenge. But there's also projects specifically looking at research managers and looking at the funders themselves. All this does fall within a European context. Indeed, I was discussing it only this morning. The European Charter and Code effectively aligns very closely with the Concordat. There's one or two areas in addition to that around intellectual property and knowledge transfer. But basically, this is an agenda that affects the entire European Union, the entire Bologna area, and it is one that is going to increasingly affect institutions. And we have deliberately created a mechanism within the UK with the Commission's agreement whereby, by implementing the Concordat and by institutions completing the HUI strategy survey that's now ongoing, they will effectively be given the tools to demonstrate their alignment with the European Charter and Code without having to go through a whole load of separate hoops. This is important. I mean, it will enable you to badge yourself as with the Charter and Code logo. It will enable you to use the Euraxis website. But increasingly, it's becoming clear that those responsible for European research funding will be asking about compliance with the European Charter and Code because they want to make sure that the experience of researchers is that they are funding the best research in the long term by providing the best experience for researchers. I'll leave you with this little quote from the University of Edinburgh's Code of Practice, which I think is really nice. Our research staff make a huge contribution to the university's international standing and reputation. They are a crucial and highly valued part of the dynamic and thriving research environment. In order to remain attractive and competitive, the university recognises it needs to have the highest quality leadership management and development of this key group of staff. If we can achieve that in every single institution, I think we'll be doing very well. Thank you.